All right, we are back on the WGXC Saturday afternoon show. I'm Tom Rowe, and we're here live at Wave Farm, where things are adjusted to much taller people. And that was an interview with Pauline Oliveros at Olana State Historic Site, where she'll be next Sunday performing as part of the Groundswell show, Framing the Viewshed Groundswell at the Olana State Historic Site on the banks of the Hudson River. And we'll be talking about that later in the show more with the members of E-Team who are here on the property, I think, within the sound of radio somewhere. And Max Goldfarb, who's probably in a car listening to the radio on the way, and Bobby Previtt, who may also be in a motor vehicle at this point. Those are all just predictions, but the prediction is they'll be here a little later. But right now, Heather Contant,
Contant.
Contant. Can't tant. Now I'm giving it. Now I'm making it all Southern.
It's spondy. It's that poetic verse that has equal accent on both syllables. It's like contant, only it's been lazy aid. Sort of like when people say acra instead of acra.
Yes. Yeah. It's hard to start going one way, and it's hard to go the other way.
You never know.
And you are the current artist in resident here in Wave Farm.
I am.
And you want sound behind you while we talk, or you want
silence? Like sound behind me.
So what are you doing here at Wave Farm? And I guess we're previewing next week at this time. You're going to do a full 2 hours, and so this is a little taste of that, I guess.
Yes. So, well, I previously have done much research. I am, at heart, a researcher. And my research primarily over the past few years, well, it's been on a number of things, but the main thing has been Weimar radio culture. First, I studied the...
Now this is a short period in history where...
Yes, that's a good point. I always forget that people
things
don't...
conspired to make radio... sort of like Italy in the 1970s is another period that people talk about as a magical time, and we're talking about Germany in the 20s.
Yeah. So the Weimar Republic was that period between World War I and World War II in Germany, and it's important because it was the first German democracy. And similarly, the same day that democracy was declared, radio was also liberated and became a public medium. And during this time, it was always just a question of what should we do with this thing that we have, this technology. An institution was built as often is. It's a much different history than the U.S. history of Wild West radio. They decided early on, the government decided to regulate things, make sure to keep it under control. But because of that, there were some people that thought things should be a little freer. And I'm going to be looking next week at a few examples. There are many that I've uncovered during my research, but I'm going to be looking at three pieces from three people that created notable work that I argue resonates with the system, either by hitting it, causing it to make a sound, or by crashing against it, knocking it down. Exactly. Or simply by symbolically reflecting, allegorizing on it. And so one of those people that we're going to talk about is Brecht, Bertolt Brecht, who wrote probably the most, well, at least in my studies, the most foundational text of the ideal of radio. And that is radio as an apparatus for communication, which basically says, wouldn't it be great if the producers, if the listeners could produce as well as transmit, if they could hear voices and speak as well as listen and hear. Yeah. two-way to many. Anyway, I just messed that one up.
It's that utopian,
you know what
vision,
I'm saying.
The utopian vision of radio being not just a thing where someone from above, the voice of God, tells you what the temperature is.
Yeah, it allows you to talk back to the voice of God.
And tell it what the temperature
exactly.
is.
Exactly. Anyway, so in this theoretical text that is perhaps impossible to realize since it is so idealistic, he often refers to a piece, a practical piece that he himself, Brecht, made with Kurt Weill and Paul Hindemith, and it was called The Flight of the Lindberghs. It's had many other names. Well, I would love to give you The Flight of the Lindberghs, which is basically a didactic learning play. It's kind of like a liturgy that you would do in church with call and response. And it's the idea is that it's a cantata for boys and girls. So children all over the place can be doing this. Well, I would have loved to have brought you that. But I decided a while ago that instead of dealing with the estate of Bertolt Brecht, I would just create my own version of a Lehrstück. So instead of The Flight of the Lindberghs, I bring you The Flight of the Lena Bird. Now, Lena was a pigeon. This is based on a true story, just like the Lindberghs' crossing of the Atlantic was. And, yep, it's a story about a bird that crashes the Iron Curtain, a racing pigeon. And the idea is that we practice these plays a lot before we can do them fully on a national system. So today I will practice with Tom, and perhaps while you're listening, I'll post the script online so that everyone else can follow along for next week, but you can use this as a model for how it goes. Okay, so are you ready, Chorus?
Do I need a script? Oh, that's my script.
That's your script, okay. Yeah. You read the red parts.
How do I tell when I begin? You'll.
I read the non-red parts.
Oh, okay. So when the non-red part ends, that's when I begin.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it. And should I? What kind of character am I?
Well, you're a chorus. You're like a Greek chorus. So you just.
I'm Jonathan Richman in the tree.
Yeah, you're just the response. It's hard to say what you are. You are every man. You are every man and every crowd. Okay, so let's see. Am I getting any sound out of my computer?
I don't think so, because it's not. You're not turned up.
Aha. If you could turn me up just a touch. I have a couple cues. Let's see.
Well, there seemed to be some strange staticky noise. I thought that was you on purpose, but I don't.
I don't think it is. Okay, maybe bring that down. We could do it without the. The cues.
You want to mic the computer?
Hold on, let me. No, because it doesn't work. Try it now. Let's see. Anything?
There's something.
There we go. It should be longer. Play. Oh, well, we will try something. Let me try something else. Okay, does that work? If this one works, that would be great. Nope, none of them work. Oh, well, we'll just do it without sound effects or just all natural sound effects. Yes. Okay.
So when my voice character is what?
You're just every man.
Every man, okay. All right, chorus, yes.
Yeah.
Greek chorus.
Yeah. Yes.
Without the accent. I can't do Greek anyways.
That's fine. Okay. Hello, my name is Lena, and I'm a German racing pigeon. I have a gray body with white speckles on my wings and head. My mother says that when I fly, I look like a shining steel angel against the bright blue sky. One day, in either June or July, or maybe it was May of 1953 or 54, or maybe it was even the year before. I simply couldn't say what the date was. The newspapers aren't even sure of the facts, so why should I be? All I know is
I flew in a race.
The night before takeoff, packed in a crate, I bounced up and down a dark highway real late. Then in the morning, about 5 o'clock, a hand throws me high in the sky to fly back to my home in my loft in Klatzenbach, or Klautzenbach, or was it Katzenbach? The newspapers aren't quite sure of that fact either, so why should I be? All I know is...
fly back to my nesting place.
In a westward direction through the vast country, friends alongside. Below I can see the fields, towns, and farms, like a big fluffy quilt beneath my outstretched arms.
I flap my wings with vigor and grace.
Then clouds from above make the sky change its hue, and the winds start a-churning, obstructing my view. I try to get my bearings straight, but all I can hear is the sloshing of rain and complete system failure of my navigational gear. My signals are crossed and my tail feathers tossed.
A loud clap of lightning, and soon I am lost.
Ah! When the heavens dry up, I find myself all alone. The storm is finally over, but where have I gone? When I look down, I notice a change in the landscape. Most of all, I'm struck by the unfamiliar flags that wave wildly above the cities, like a strand of unwound cassette tape. My internal compass reboots. It tells me I'm traveling a bit too far east. But all the people are the same. For some reason, I thought they'd be beasts or red-shouldered hawks. That's what they told me when I was growing up back in the West. But these people call themselves simply...
communists!
Well, I am a bird, and that word has no meaning. Anyway, my wings are getting tired, and I need to rest. I land in a town called Pilsen, where I meet a nice human that offers me a warm and cozy nest. As I drift off to bed, he pats me on the head and attaches a note to my leg, which says, uh-oh, and now we have the serious, like, Q meltdown. Hold on. Let's see if we can, yes, that's what it says. It says, hooray, free us from communist oppression, Radio Free Europe. We love you and we listen to you every day and every night. We would like a United States of Europe. I wake up refreshed and ready to fly. I say thanks to the man who points to the sky. He begs me to go to Munich in the west, to the stations of Radio Free Europe, where his message is addressed. The sun on my back warms up my wings. It lights up my path, and I notice even more things. The buildings are taller, recently rebuilt. But the people are still the same, so I don't get why so many of you humans felt that east and west were different. Why don't you people understand? When you draw maps, things just get so out of hand. Leave the mapping to us pigeons, because for us, it's instinct. And when all those invisible boundaries disappear, you'll finally have time to think. Hey, look, now I'm in Munich. Wow, that was fast. I brought my message to some guy who reads it on the air and tries to reply. And he's all like, hello, hello, we hear you, we hear you, we hear you, Pilsens. After that, I became a spokespigeon in the United States. I got into an airplane and flew, this time without my wings, to a faraway place. When I landed in New York City, there was a big celebration. 1,000 pigeons from all across the nation. Copies of my letter are sent to the president and to Henry Ford, chairman of the Crusade for Freedom. After a party, I go into the room. Isolated and lonely, I feel like a broom. I long to combine with others, to see my feathered friends. But on the door it says simply, quarantine. In less than a month, I move yet again to a dovecote in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, at their big air place. All the famous pigeons live in that place. I have warmth and protection and share food with my friends. And that's where the story of this lost little pigeon, thanks for tuning in, happily ends. So that was a good rehearsal. I think I see some places to fix, like the technology part. But you know, it's interesting. Technology failures and catastrophes is also something we'll be looking at next week in the first. Well, it's credited as the very first radio drama by Hans Flesch, and it is called Zauberei auf dem Sender, which can be translated as sorcery of the air, or witchcraft of the transmitter, or magic broadcast, or enchanted radio. Yes, and we'll be interviewing the people who are translating Hans Flesch's writing.
Do you have any idea why the Germans like radio theater so much? Because it's still popular to this day, more so than, I guess, in the United States or Britain.
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I don't have a good answer. Neither do the Germans that I do speak with have a particularly good answer. Well, actually, most of the ones that I speak with are like, yeah, it's not doing so well over there right now either.
Radio everywhere is getting cut.
Exactly.
The shortwave programs across the globe are getting budget cuts every month. There's a new story about something else getting cut.
Yeah. Well, yesterday there was just a new story about American radio, public radio, getting cut again. But why? I don't know. It's I don't have a definitive answer. I could say it has something to do, I could theorize, if I were Friedrich Kittler, that it has something to do with the fact that language teaching is a acoustic phenomenon passed from mother to child. And sometimes the mother is tired and wants to take a break, so here's radio. There is an interesting tradition, especially in Weimar radio, of children's programming that really is not nearly as popular today. But they really made an effort to appeal to children and to teach children through the radio. So this, for example, was the Lehrstück, that Brecht created. He didn't really create it, but extended and worked on, and that we just sort of got an example of here in The Flight of the Lena Bird. Well, that comes from the proletarian theaters of Russia and all sorts of interesting history. It's the idea of teaching children to be active proletariat community members. And yeah, not all of German radio was like that, but the people that I will be looking at, they were all lefties.
And what drew you, I guess, to German radio or German radio in this period in particular? Or?
That's a really good question. It started basically with me finding a hole in the literature, going to the library, having a question, and not being able to find the answer, which I guess that's a pretty good way of conducting scholarship. But yeah, that's about it. And I heard a piece that I liked and wondered, wow, where can I hear more things like that? And tried to find out and couldn't figure it out. And so I thought, well, I'll just have to fill it with my own.
It was a story that needed to be told.
It was a story that needed to be told, and a constellation that needed to be made out of history. Yeah, so the other person we're going to be talking about, speaking of constellations in history, is Walter Benjamin, who...
What is his role in radio?
He was actually a practitioner, which surprises even the professors that I tell when I bump into them at the grocery store. People that should know, that teach Walter Benjamin all the time. They don't even know that he was a practitioner. He did write...
He had a crystal radio kit in his garage.
Did he?
No, I'm...
That would have been funny. No, he was working with Ernst Schön and Hans Flesch to deliver lectures to children. And his stories, he just was very much a storyteller. None of this participatory radio with lines and non-existent electronic cues. He did a very simple form of radio storytelling, 20 minutes each. And they've never been translated into English, ever. Which is quite odd because his writing is popular. So I'm translating one of them. It's a story about a crash, a train crash, a collapse. He has many stories about disaster.
Children's stories about
children's disasters. Stories about disasters. Yes, of course. Well, you got to keep in mind, he also wrote the history of German tragic drama. So I guess that's just, yeah, he was into catastrophe. It was definitely one of his fascinations. And actually,
and catastrophe works well on the radio. You have to look through history.
It really
and you
does.
Can,
it, yeah. And radio is so prone to catastrophe in the very literal day to day, running back and forth, pushing the wrong button at the wrong time, leaving something else on, always tiny, tiny, tiny catastrophes. But life goes on. And then sometimes, which we unfortunately see at the end of the Weimar Republic, radio can also lead to bigger catastrophes, massive political catastrophes.
Was there a Leni Riefenstahl of radio?
Well, yeah, I mean, Goebbels, basically. They called the receiver that was really cheap and everyone was able to buy it, that the Third Reich promoted. It was called the Goebbels nose, because it was just it looked like a big pig's nose. So they called it Goebbels nose. And,
that was who was they in that context? The people of Germany.
The people of Germany.
So is that telling you he was a beloved leader or at that point?
I don't. No, not really. Not at that point so much. No, definitely not at that point. I'm not sure anyone would. I think that was a difficult time to say that you didn't love someone though. A leader.
Right. Yes, I thought maybe that was a subtle way of acknowledging
yes.
your distaste.
Right. That radio was tuned to two frequencies. You could pick up the local channel, which was run by the state, or the national channel.
It only had two. It was not like a dial of many possibilities. It was a dial of two.
Yes.
Pre-chosen solutions.
Yes.
So to speak.
So you had choice A or choice B.
Because there was I just read recently, I think, about some, there was a Dutch group or that was sending pirate radio signals into Germany early in the war and trying to get people to listen.
Yeah, radio jamming started with the Germans trying to jam Russian signals. And then during the Cold War, it was kind of reversed. When the Russians were jamming Western signals into the Soviet Union. So
there was also, I guess it's come out fairly recently, or 96, I think this started coming out, but the U.S. Army had this whole division that was doing pirate radio during the war and sending out fake, doing fake broadcasts and actually doing radio theater on the air, broadcasting to the German army, faking the German army out over and over again.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. That's during the Cold War?
Yeah, if you search for Ghost Army, there's a documentary about the Ghost Army. And one part, there was three parts of it. One, they were making like fake tanks, and that was one part of it, doing theater in the field, actual theater, not radio.
Right.
And then there was actual radio theater, and then the third part was, I don't remember what the third part is. There's always a third part. Yeah, I'm Rick Perry.
Things always come in threes, and they don't always become remembered.
The Education Department.
Yay!
That
sounds
thing.
About right. I mean, that sounds kind of like a... I mean, it pretty much sounds like a...
So there was all kinds of pirate radio in Germany. In, not probably pre... Hitler was probably not too nice to the pirates interiorly. or
no.
Other voices
I
on
don't
the
think,
air.
Yeah, not... I mean, German radio did start out...
Well, that's what you were saying.
A month.
It was trying to be the utopian multi, and it led to just one voice.
Yeah, yeah. It tried, but it didn't quite.
So in 20 years' time, or less than 20 years' time, it went from all voices to just one voice.
Yeah.
And that's the story you're going to tell.
Yes. But then there were some things that alluded to the possibilities of more than one voice, of multiplicitous radio, and those are the ones that I find interesting. They are what I call epiphanies. Epic phonies, phonic whatever sounds, which in turn cause an epiphany. I saw someone in the saw someone in the door over there.
Oh, we have other guests, so they may be arriving now and are just terrified of the that there might be Nazis in the room or something.
Oh, no.
We've scared them with this talk of radio long ago.
Oh, I don't think...
Perhaps.
The thing about radio long ago is so much of it has just disappeared into the ether. There's nothing you can really worry about.